Hello, this is Profiles, and I'm your host, Scott Witzke. Today we welcome to the FIU studio one of the world's leading performers and foremost authorities on the lute. Nigel North is professor at the IU Jacob School of Music's Early Music Institute. His music career spans almost 40 years and includes roles as teacher, accompanist, director, and author. Nigel maintains an international career and has performed on over 100 recordings. His quiet, gentle personality goes hand in hand with the gentle, subtle, and technically demanding character of the lute. Nigel, welcome to Profiles. It's our pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you.
I guess the first question I'd like to ask is, how did you choose the lute? How did you start playing the lute?
This is always difficult to know which angle to take. As a very young child, I played the violin, and then I got into playing electric guitar a little bit, pretty modestly, then classical guitar. And by the time I was about 12, I knew what the lute was, roughly. I liked playing lute music on the guitar. Mm-hmm. And so for a few years, and this was in the late 60s, I was thinking, well, how can I get a lute? How can I play this music? It was mostly Bach that I was thinking was lute music, but I knew about Dowland as well. And so I just sort of looked around, asked around, and eventually, when I was 15, one of the guitar teachers in London had a lute. It wasn't a very good one, but it wasn't bad. And I got that, and I'd been playing lute music on the guitar, so I just sort of went from one instrument to the other, pretended they were the same, and just started teaching myself. That's a shortened version of the story.
So was it a Renaissance lute or a Baroque lute that you were playing Bach on?
I didn't even at that stage know what the difference was. It's so amazing now, 30-odd years later, how much we know about all the various types of lutes. It was an 8-course lute, and for those of the listeners, that means 8 pairs of strings. But in fact, like the lute that Julian Bream used to play, the first and the second were single, but that wasn't really an authentic performance sort of practice thing. But that's what it was, because all lutes then were made roughly to sound like the lute that Julian Bream played.
Mm-hmm. So that first lute that you had, was the action easy to play? Was it would you say it was a nice lute, or you made do with what was available at the time?
I had to make do. It had metal frets.
Okay.
So it was a real sort of guitar lute, but it actually was quite small. It wasn't sort of big and massive. It had not exactly a guitar sound, but I remember that the action was quite high. So in the hot weather, it always felt worse than in the cold weather. But I was very lucky it came in a big, huge coffin case. But, you know, somebody at 15 in whatever it was, 90, end of the 60s, it was, you know, it was great. I could have a lute and read all this music and learn to read notation and tablature on that instrument.
Did you play with nails? I know with guitarists, guitarists often have fingernails that they pluck the strings with, whereas lutenists nowadays sometimes play with nails, but other times use the flesh of the finger.
I was aware that there were different ways of producing the sound, but all the recordings I'd heard then, they were all of Julian Bream, and so he was a big figurehead for me. And I was playing guitar and I had nails, so I just used that. And it wasn't till about 5 years later, I think, I decided, because I'd heard one person play the lute well without nails, I thought, no, I think I'd really like to do that. And I could feel that it was going to be worth making a change.
You mentioned that you started off playing the violin. Mm-hmm. Did you grow up in a musical family? Was there music around?
Mm-hmm. I almost don't know where in the genes where the music came from, because my family wasn't musical really. My father was already dead by the time I was 7. My mum can't sing in tune, still can't. But her dad was the sort of musical. So if there's any link, it was to my granddad. But he wasn't a professional. He just liked singing and he played brass instruments a bit. And, you know, from that point of view, who knows why I wanted to play music. But just one day I said to my mum, there was a violin in a music shop. And I just said, I want to play that. Such a difficult instrument to play as a child. But it did, that was a really good education for me, because I got to read music. I got to think about playing melodic lines. I played in orchestras and chamber music, and I learned all theory and counterpoint, all because I was a violinist. So it was hard, but it was a very good way to do it.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Nigel North here in the studios of WFIU, and you're listening to Profiles. You mentioned about listening to Bach and listening to classical music. Did you listen to classical music primarily as a child, or was there other music that really caught your ear?
The first thing that caught my ear, I think, was even before my father died. He'd bring home from work lots of singles, we call them. Mm-hmm. Do they still call singles?
45s, the small.
Yeah. And there was an English group called The Shadows that was the first thing that struck my ear. And I didn't really know what classical music was then, but I'd spend all my time listening to their records. I bought them all. When I got the electric guitar, you know, I bought all the sheet music and tried to play from that all by ear. And that was more the enjoyment, let's say, between the ages of 7 and 10, and the violin was just hard work.
Did you practice a lot, or did you have to be forced to practice?
A bit of both, actually. I remember with the violin being told several times, you know, well, you should do, let's say, half an hour a day. And sometimes it worked easier than others. And there was a stage, I think, on the violin when I found I could begin to play in tune. And then from between 10, 11 and 15, it was hard to stop me. So in fact, most of the time I either went to concerts after school. Incredible now to think how protective we are of our children. Mm-hmm. But in London, I'd go up on the tube, the underground, go to concerts, come back again. And it was either of violin music, concertos, sonatas, or guitar concerts. I did sort of that. Or I just practice at home. So I was pretty unsociable and just immersed myself in music. I loved to sight read as well. Mm-hmm. And various friends, teachers gave me piles of music. Here you are, look at that. And I just, you know, go and read through sonatas and concertos, or go up to London once a week and buy new guitar music.
Such an important skill. A lot of guitarists and lutenists learn to read tablature, which is a musical shorthand where they aren't actually reading the notes. And so many are unable to read notes, but from that violin background, it seems like it helped you in moving forward quicker.
Yeah.
This seems like a good time to take a break and to listen to a musical selection. Is there anyone that you'd like to listen to?
Well, from what we've talked about, we could start with The Shadows. As we've said, that was the first thing that caught my musical attention. I really don't listen to them now, although I've got a whole set of recordings at home. I've chosen a fairly unknown track called Nivram, which is a sort of simple jazzy type thing, but they weren't really a jazz group. Mm-hmm. But actually, it's if I listen to anything from them now, that might be the track I'd put on.
We've been listening to The Shadows, and you're listening to WFIU. My name is Scott Witzke, and we're talking with lutenist Nigel North today. Do you have a favorite composer, somebody that you idolize?
Certainly have a favorite composer, which would be Bach. Mm-hmm. I think it's always been that. It's strange at the moment. In fact, I don't really listen at home to music very much. A bit too much like a busman's holiday. but when I do listen to music, I realize there's so much, even of my favorite composer, Bach, that I don't know. Mm. So sometimes I'll delve into a cantata or a concerto or something that's just new to me.
You released a 4-CD set of Bach on the lute. What went into producing that? It seems that took a long time. I know from your website, nigelnorth.com, there's a lot of information about from late 70s up until the late 80s when you were working on these transcriptions. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Trying to find the short story again, in about 1974, I think I got my first Baroque lute once I realized how that was different from a Renaissance lute. And I started exploring the music that was available. And I knew that I wanted to play Bach. And I took a few lessons with a wonderful German lute player called Michael Schäfer. He lived in Cologne. He died in 77, early in life. But I was lucky to hear him play, and I had about 8 lessons with him. And in one of the lessons, he had a transcription of a Bach violin sonata for the lute. I'd taken the lute suite in G minor, which is also the 5th cello suite, for the lesson. And he said, you know, what about this? Don't you think this sounds like good lute music? So he played it for me, which was wonderful. And that sort of sparked my interest in, well, I wonder, you know, let's try that. We had our lessons in Holland, where there was also another teacher, Gusta Goldschmidt, and she was also working on transcriptions. So that was the beginning of the story. Then over the next, you know, 20 years, I started making my own transcriptions, playing them bit by bit, of all the solo violin pieces and all the solo cello suites. And that's what comprised those 4 CDs that you mentioned.
Many people are familiar with the guitar and maybe not so familiar with the lute. How are they similar? How are they different?
Differences are that they come from 2 separate lines of development. Of course, the similarities, they're both plucked stringed instruments. And today there are lots of different types of guitar, but basically always 6 strings. Depending on how you tune or amplify them. And the lute came from the Arabic lute, the oud. It was originally played with a quill or a plectrum, and then by about 15th century, 1500s, was played with the fingers. Most lutes have double strings. That requires a certain touch to make that work. The tunings vary, the number of strings vary. It's altogether a much more complicated instrument. Similarities, guitar and lute, they sound harmonic. But one of the things the lute can do is actually play really wonderful counterpoint, which is what lutenists did in the 16th century, almost exclusively. The Baroque lute is the most far away from the guitar, in that it has 1 set of strings, not tuned like the guitar at all, which you play with both hands. You pluck and you stop. But then from the lowest of those fingerboard strings, you then have another whole octave of open strings tuned like a harp that goes down in a scale. And so the whole tone color and world, sound world of that type of lute is much more resonant. It's bigger, completely different.
In the sound, I know that nowadays we prize instruments for their ability to play loud. During the Renaissance and Baroque, the lute is such a quiet instrument, but they prized this sound for its ability to play soft. So maybe at their modern ears, how does one accustom themselves to hearing the lute?
I think the lute has to be heard in an acoustic that works for the instrument. Hearing it on recordings is one of the ideal ways of getting to know it, because it's so intimate. The lute's chief asset is not its volume, but its chief asset, I think, is the expression you can get from it, the variety of sounds, the way of speaking that you can get from playing the lute. And it's not a sort of socket to you in the face sort of instrument. Well, neither is the guitar. And I think some of the best qualities of the guitar I like is when it's actually quite gentle and intimate. Mm-hmm. I hope that answers it. Mm-hmm.
You talk about the lute where you pluck. I've heard people say that lutes and guitars are special because you're fingering it with the left hand and you're creating the sound with your right hand where your body is engulfing the music. And unlike a piano, not to degrade the piano, but we hit the key, a kid can start and play the piano and they get a good sound, whereas the lute, or especially a violin, you have this stereotype of a person sawing away at a violin because as a kid it's very difficult to make a good sound. One of the lessons that you've always taught with the lute is to make a good sound. Life is too short to make bad sounds. You also mentioned about recordings. The CD is the optimal way to hear the lute. Has the perfect performance and conditions of a CD, has that helped or hindered the live concert-going experience?
I think the benefits of the recordings that we can hear now is that more people can hear the lute, they can hear all the different composers. And if it's well recorded, you know, you can get a very good sense of the instrument, the tone of each instrument and the tone of each player, and that varies so enormously. It's a completely false thing. As a friend of mine in Canada said, you don't expect when you watch a movie that it's going to be a video of a stage play. You know that it's put together to be a certain type of creation. And so when I go and record, I don't think that I'm cheating, that it's not like a concert. It does get edited. I can't ever play perfectly. Strings go out of tune, aeroplanes go over, and that sort of thing. And playing to people in concerts is such a different thing. I think if I had to give up one, I'd give up recording. The most enjoyable thing is to sit in front of a few people or several or hundreds, doesn't really matter, and share the music, and each time it's different. So if I could keep that, that's what I'd like. I do tend to learn a lot from recording. Having to prepare, having to listen very, very well, so that you, I know how it's going to sound on the recording. That has taught me a lot. It's a very tough process.
You've had a career that's spanned almost 40 years, a little over 35 years, and you got in early music with some of the pioneers in Britain, David Munro, Alfred Deller, Bob Spencer. How has early music changed in the past 35, 40 years?
It certainly has changed a great deal. On basic levels, I think the competence and the artistry of singers and instrumentalists has grown enormously. I think musicology and performance practice have grown together. And now it's not so much a funny thing that one or two people do and you put up with things that aren't quite good enough. But it's really good music making that musicians of very good quality are giving us. It's now part of mainstream. In fact, I wonder soon if the term early music will just be dropped. It's just so-and-so playing Bach or so-and-so playing Dowland. I think it's lost its sort of nostalgic quality for me. So, for example, I can remember listening to an Alfred Deller recording in the late 60s, and it was such a discovery. And now we take so much for granted for all sorts of reasons.
Early musicians tend to come to their instruments late in life, where you don't pick up the lute at age 4 and become a virtuoso. But now I'm starting to see more and more young people playing lute. There are camps. So you were mentioning that the level of musicianship has gone up quite a bit. In the past, American scholars and musicians had to go to Europe and study. Here at IU, we have their Early Music Institute, which was founded by Thomas Binkley. They've brought in faculty from around the world. Can an early musician, an American early musician, have a career in the U.S., or does it still require them to go to Europe, where the tradition was born?
What I notice is that there are many musicians from this country who are trained here, and their life is sort of centered around music making in America. I think most of them do go off to Europe to play. I think it's valuable for young musicians to travel and to go to different cultures, different ways of learning music. So I would always recommend to a young student, go off to Europe for a while. Mm. It's become so international now that I don't think it's so separated. But still, there's a huge cultural difference between European teaching and playing and what I notice here in North America.
This seems like a nice place to take a break and listen to some music. You've been talking about some of your lutenists that you listened to growing up. Is there one in particular that you would choose?
Oh, absolutely. Maybe we could listen to two things in succession. I would have to choose something from Julian Bream because he was the first and for quite a while the only lute player that I heard. And there's a record, an old record, called Lute Music of the Golden Age, made in 1961. I must say, I don't think I heard it then. It was a few years later. And 40 years on, the style is so different from what we're used to now. But Julian Bream was certainly a huge inspiration. And let's listen to the Robert Johnson Fantasy from this record.
You've been listening to A Fantasia by Robert Johnson. My name is Scott Witzke, and I'm interviewing Nigel North, lutenist here in the studios of WFIU. In addition, we also heard Thomas Morley consort lessons. Nigel, what was special about that Morley consort?
Well, in those years of late 60s, early 70s, David Monroe was a real pioneer, a wonderful musician, and this record of two dance bands, Suzzato and Morley, was something that I played a lot and wore out. And the music of the Broken Consort, the English collection of six particular instruments that we've just heard, That was also something that fascinated me a lot then. And I was incredibly lucky also to meet David Munro. He was very kind to me and also got me to go and play with the group in his last 2 years. So I got lots to thank him for. And this particular group that we heard, the lute player Desmond Dupre died, and there was an opening, and that was one of my first professional jobs. And David said, would you like to come and play in it? So there are lots of reasons for choosing that and remembering all these people.
You talked about playing the violin, and you talked mm-hmm. about coming into the lute. You're mostly self-taught. Mm-hmm. From your website, nigelnorth.com, I learned that as a student, you were hired as lute instructor at the Guildhall School mm-hmm. in London. Tell me a little bit about that.
Mm. I think I was just such an obnoxious student that I didn't actually want to learn with anybody. There weren't many teachers to choose from mm-hmm. at that time, but I think it was just a little bit of my arrogance and a little bit of I really wanted to discover things on my own. I still have that. And I did 3 years at the Royal College of Music, where I was supposed to be studying guitar, mm-hmm. didn't practice much, and I was playing the lute all the time. And then I went to the Guildhall School of Music to do a sort of one-year specialisation in early music. And just during that year, they asked me to teach the lute. And then that was something I carried on doing for quite a few years.
How many students did you have?
It's very different from here. And that varied, of course. You know, it's a conservatory. Basically, students come to learn their instrument, and I'd go in and teach 1 or 2 days a week. But I think at its heyday, I might have had something like 18 students. Mm. But regularly, I looked at the register that I've kept. I had about 10 all the time. Mm. London's now become a very expensive place to study. And although I don't teach at the Guildhall, I know that at all the schools there are about 1 or 2 students, which is a shame, but it's just a different time.
When you say at the Royal College, is that where Diana Poulton, did you ever have the occasion of meeting her? This Diana yeah. Poulton, the famous Dallin scholar.
Yeah, Diana was when I was the guitar student, she was the lute teacher. And as I say, I was a pretty obnoxious student. But for one term, I took lessons with Diana mm-hmm. before I left.
You taught at the Guildhall for 21 years. You've also mm-hmm. taught in Berlin mm-hmm. and in the Netherlands. And in 1999, you came to IU to join the Early Music Institute. Mm-hmm. Here, I think Bloomington has more lutenists per square inch than any other small town in the U.S. You were mostly self-taught. What lessons did you learn? What mistakes did you make that you learned from greatly, and the things that make you a great teacher?
I think because I wanted to explore things on my own, that meant I was curious. And it also meant that if I didn't do the listening myself, nobody else was going to do it. If I didn't do the observations myself, or the research, nobody else would do it. So that all helped to shape me. And it's those qualities, I think, particularly the one of learning how to listen, is what I'd like to help students develop in themselves. Mm-hmm. Most of all, I love the idea of what's in a person musically. That's what's there, and that's my job is to help bring it out. I can't put anything there that's not there. I refuse to spoon-feed people because mm-hmm. I don't feel that's what I want to do. Mm-hmm. Curiosity and listening, I think, are the two main subjects. Yeah.
You're not only a soloist on the lute, one of your key professions as a continuo player, the art of accompanying on the lute, and you've written a book mm-hmm. on continuo playing. How did you go about teaching yourself continuo? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of harpsichordists and keyboardists where continuo kind of makes sense. Yes. In the lute world, it is more difficult, I would say.
Yeah. Again, a long story which I'll try and shorten, but I remember at school, round about 15, I heard a recording of Orfeo from Monteverdi, and there was a chitarrone in that. Well, there were two or three in a harp. And from that moment, I thought, I want to do that. And I realized at that stage that lute instruments did play harmonic accompaniments which you improvised. Mm. And from the start, I sort of pursued, well, I want to find out what to do. And various people asked me to play, what do you play in this and that? So the first thing I remember having to do was to play in a Monteverdi opera. I took over from somebody and I played the written part that somebody had put into tablature. But after the 20 or 30 performances, I was not playing the written part, but I was reading from the bass line. And then very close after that, somebody asked me to play in Orfeo of Monteverdi. So I made myself read the bass line, learn what the figures were. And from then on, particularly by having to teach it, I learnt stage by stage how to understand the practice and improve. So it's something I continue to educate myself in. And actually one of the biggest educations was in London. In the 70s and 80s, I played with a lot of big groups and baroque orchestras. It involved a lot of sight reading. And that's, I must say, where I learned on the job, really, how to play basso continuo on the lute, just by having to do it, again, by listening.
It's an important skill, I guess, sometimes. As classical musicians, we're so ingrained in the music. The composer has set down these notes, mm-hmm. and we're only supposed to play what he or she has written and not embellish on that. Whereas in the Renaissance and Baroque, this was not the case. Mm-hmm. How do you teach improvisation, or how does one get someone away from the music and outside of the stereotypes of classical music?
Mm. I find it actually quite hard to teach improvisation. In terms of playing harmony and playing basso continuo, it's for me more of learning to think like the composer. So there's a lot of understanding why the harmony is as it is, how the counterpoint in it works, and that's, of course, all there in the music that we have to play. So teaching somebody to improvise an accompaniment means really going back to the center of why was a piece of music written the way it was written. Melodic improvisation, I think, comes best from copying. So, for example, in English Renaissance lute music, such as Dowland, we have a lot of written-out versions of ornaments. Mm-hmm. And by playing those, listening to them, even without understanding it, I think one can build up a beginning to a style of improvisation. And apart from that, there are several manuals that we can do, and I have done a bit. You go into it, you learn by rote, you see all the formulas, everybody does it in a different way, so it's very incremental. Bit by bit, you can build up this facility. But for me, the most common world that I've been in for improvising is the one of accompaniment.
Continuo is making up your own composition, and I know you've expressed a very keen interest in Tuck and Patty, a jazz guitarist and vocalist. And you selected one of their pieces, Heaven Down Here. Would you like to tell me a little bit about this piece and why you've selected it?
The song is just one of my favorites from, goodness knows, probably 100 tracks that we could choose from. What Tuck and Patty represent to me as musicians is such a good combination of singing and accompaniment, the way they listen to each other and interact with each other, the blend of the harmony and the text. It's a very, very different style, which I can't play in, never learnt to play in. But it's that there are two people making music as though it's one person, and they do it so beautifully.
isn't it love in this life that you need? You can offer your soul to an altar of sacrifice, but give your heart to me. Let's bring heaven down here. Let's bring heaven.
You've been listening to Tuck Unpatty. You're listening to Profiles on WFIU. Our guest today is lutenist Nigel North. You were talking earlier about continuo and making up and an accompaniment and two musicians working as one. Is human voice, is that an important instrument to you?
Mm-hmm. It's probably been the thread through most of my life. It's interesting, but I feel that I am an instrumentalist because I find it very easy to remember tunes and pretty difficult to remember lyrics. Mm-hmm. But some of the most enjoyable music making has been accompanying singers. I've done that a lot. I do feel very at home doing that in different languages. Maybe that would be the one performing I'd like to maintain if I had to give up everything else. Mm. So I'd give up playing on my own if I could play concerts just with one singer. And at a certain time in life, around about when I moved here in 1999, I did experiment with, well, what's it like to sing and play at the same time? I'd left it too late, really, to really do this seriously, but I did learn a lot from it. I don't do it anymore now. But what I loved was that the telling the story and singing and communicating was absolutely the only important thing when it came to actually performing. And so the accompaniment to the songs had to be so automatic and well-learned that would just go on in the background. It's quite a challenge doing both together.
I'm amazed. I've seen you do this many times, and it's very convincing. We think of the singer-songwriter of nowadays, the folk singer or the pop singer. Well, we think of Dowland as sort of the singer-songwriter of his day. And these Elizabethan lute songs or Renaissance lute songs are very powerful. Their accompaniment is complex, and their words are extremely vivid poetry. So you find that rewarding. You mentioned coming to Bloomington from London, teaching there for 21 years, but living there your entire life. We have an internationally renowned school of music where people are coming in all the time. Did you have any difficulties dealing with a small Midwestern town, or for all those people who are just here into Bloomington and moved here from an international city, what advice do you have them to help them integrate into the Bloomington life?
This is a very interesting and difficult question. I had lived in London virtually all my life, so 45 years or so before I came here, and I was ready for a big change in life, and it's taken me at least 8 years to get used to it, because it is so incredibly different. And the switch has been that I don't really have any hankering to go back to London to live. If there was any advice I would give, would be don't take anything too seriously. To live here in such a small community, I think it's easy for things to feel more important than they are. That's my own personal thing. Get out as much as possible, but appreciate also what's here. And that's what's taken me at least 8 years to get to that stage. I appreciate what's here. I get out enough. And that blend helps to keep a perspective on life. And that the grass is never greener anywhere. you know, it's always, everything's always a compromise. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a life lesson for me. Which I had to learn this way by coming from London, which had so many things to offer, to a very different lifestyle, which I now appreciate very much.
I've mentioned that you've written books. You wrote a book on continuo. You also edited music. You've recorded on over 100 CDs. What projects are you working on now? Is there anything in particular that you've been recording as of late?
Mm-hmm. For playing and recording, it's been for the last 3 or 4 years mostly Dowland. As we talk, I'm just about to go off and do the fourth of the four CDs, and about 100 pieces in total, and I take a chunk of 25 each year, and it's been lovely to have the time to get to know this music that I've always wanted to know. And after that, I've started looking and playing in Robert Johnson, who's sort of half a generation older than Dowland. So that's what I'll do next in that series. And continuing, I'm just revising all the Bach pieces that I've played and getting in back to 17th century French lute music, which I used to play 20 or 30 years ago. And I'm finding it harder to keep 3 or 4 lutes going all at the same time. So if I'm playing Dowland, it's very difficult for me now to suddenly switch instruments and worlds and play some Bach or some Dufo and so on. Mm-hmm. So I have to do each one separately. But it's good to have the space and the time to do that.
One of the things in our society, we're inundated with music. We hear it everywhere. Do you have any ideas on keeping the music fresh or dealing with musical burnout?
Yes. In fact, I try to close my ears in airports and so on. It's impossible. And I actually try not to listen to too much music unconsciously because I do want to preserve the fact that music is a very special thing. And you know, each time I listen to it, I want to do it with full attention. So I try not to have music on as a background thing. So if I hear something on the radio that I like, then I will, if I can, stop and listen to it properly. But it's very hard with it going on everywhere all the time. I'm determined to encourage our son, who's now a year and a half, not to get used to music in the background. So we don't play it that much at home.
Mm-hmm. Is there a lot of music making in your house? I know your wife is a gombist, and so you have a lot of musical opportunity. Do you play for your child?
Yeah. Well, I would think every day he hears us. Certainly he hears me practice every day because he's so young. He doesn't hear his mum practice all the time. We've tried a routine that every time we begin practicing, the other one who's not practicing stays with him and we listen a little bit. And then we go away and do other stuff. So he hears a lot of music from us all the time. And, of course, he comes crashing into my room and wants to grab the lute string. So we do that. And he sometimes makes a very good sound.
Do you take him to concerts?
We have done. That's getting harder and harder as he gets more active. But he knows what concerts are. He's been to rehearsals. So music's there. And he's got a very good sense of rhythm. So when he hears music, he moves or he beats absolutely in time. It's wonderful.
Well, I think that brings our interview to a close. Our guest was lutenist Nigel North. Nigel, thank you for spending some time with us this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
The program you just heard was recorded in June of 2007. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Emily McCord was our research assistant. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.